Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Rebecca Schwartz-Loos, the author of Brainscapes, the Warped, Wondrous Maps Written in Your Brain, and How They Guide You, a path-breaking journey into the brain, showing how perception, thought, and action are products of maps etched into your gray matter, and how technology can use to read your mind. Your brain is a collection of maps. That is no metaphor. Scrolled across your brain's surfaces are actual maps of the sights, sounds, and actions that hold the key to your survival. Scientists first began uncovering these maps over a century ago, but we are only now beginning to unlock their secrets and comprehend their profound impact on our lives. Brain maps distort and shape our experience of the world, support complex thought, and make technology-enabled mind reading a modern-day reality, which raises important questions about what is real, what is fair, and what is private. They shine a light on our past and our possible futures. In the process, they invite us to view ourselves from a startling new perspective. In Brainscapes, Rebecca Schwartz-Loos combines unforgettable real-life stories, cutting-edge research, and vivid illustrations to reveal brain maps' surprising lessons about our place in the world and about the world's place within us. Well, Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Galina. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. So as we're living through the unprecedented times during the pandemic, a little bit more into the, hopefully, the last part of the pandemic, I'd like to ask, how has it influenced you and your work?
That's a great question. I can start by saying that I'm very grateful to have, weathered the pandemic with a job and, with my health. I know so many people are struggling right now and have been struggling for a while. For me, I think in terms of its impact on my work, that was most substantial when I was during the shutdown, lockdown period in the United States in March and April. At that time, I have two young daughters, and so they were home with me full time. That was also when I was trying to finish the edits to my book. So it was very busy obviously just kind of working when I could and how I could, kind of desperately, to meet deadlines and get everything done. And at the same time, my mother was ill, so just a lot of complications, obviously, trying to navigate caring for loved ones long distance. More recently, someone from our family passed away from COVID, and it was just, truly tragic. My heart goes out to everybody who has been struggling during this time. But thankfully, I feel fortunate that I was able to finish the book, and I've been able to carry out my research, and my kids and myself, my husband, we're doing well.
Yeah, for sure. It has been quite a trying time for many people. And how did you manage to adjust to some things? Like, have you homeschooled your kids during this time?
They were home for a while. So we did some of that, which was very challenging to be working and also having them learning from home, especially with my younger one. When they're very young, they really don't engage with something like Zoom. At least my daughter didn't. But now they are back in school, and I'm grateful that we now know enough about masking and how to take the proper precautions to keep kids safe in school.
And you yourself, did you find ways to manage perhaps the extra stress, maybe going for walks or doing something like meditation?
oh, you know, those things sound lovely. I think as a mom with young kids, especially during the pandemic, and a working mom at that, those are the things I dreamed of doing, but I never really found the time. So, you know, really just a deep breath here and there. And just keeping in mind how fortunate, you know, I am, and you know, how, you know, we can sort of move forward just one step in front of the other and think about how we can help others as well.
That's a great attitude. Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Absolutely. So I was born in Chicago. I was a very introspective child. So I kind of actually got interested in the mind and brain pretty early, like in middle school. I was really, really interested in part just kind of observing others' behavior and then my own, and sort of noticing how my brain got me to the actions that I took. I knew I wanted to study psychology by the time I was in undergrad, starting my college, which was Northwestern University is where I got my bachelor's degree. And so I studied psychology there and also fell in love with linguistics. So I was really thinking about going into phonetics and phonology, which is the kind of speech sounds and the processing, like the creation of speech and the processing of those sounds. It's sort of at the intersection of acoustics and anatomy and language and also the mind. In the kind of midway through my undergraduate years, I sort of really wanted to get deeper with the brain as a physical entity that creates thought, and also, you know, think about the ways in which the brain can, you know, be disrupted and how that can lead to mental illness or developmental problems. And so I kind of shifted gears to take more classes that would, you know, permit me to study neuroscience in my graduate work. And I loved that. And then I went straight to graduate school at MIT in the Brain and Cognitive Sciences department, which was a great environment for learning about both cognitive science and neuroscience and the intersection of the two. And there I wound up doing my doctoral work with Nancy Kanwisher, who was a fantastic mentor and just a wonderful scientist. She does neuroimaging research. And at the time, she was focused in particular on visual object recognition and face recognition. So I learned a ton from her about designing careful experiments and thinking through cognitive function and interpreting neural activity from brain scans. And that was wonderful. And in the process, one of the things that we did together was we characterized this new area. So Dr. Kanwisher is well known for characterizing an area called the fusiform face area, which it's an area that's very important for face recognition. And right next to it, there was evidence that there was a body selectivity, some part of the brain that was showing activity on brain scans when you looked at a body rather than a face. And so we characterized that area and showed that it was a separate neighboring area, always right next to the face area, snuggled up together. And that really kind of, that curiosity about why those two regions were always right next to each other, sandwiched together, just like heads and bodies are, is one of the things that set me on the course of investigating brain maps, which is the focus of my book.
Interesting. So have you studied it from the perspective of cortical columns, the arrangement of the brain cells?
So I have not. My work has been with neuroimaging, which is obviously at the unit of a voxel, which is kind of like a little cube of brain, which includes many, many, many cortical columns. So the resolution of the functional MRI is not nearly so good as what one would have if you were doing, for example, studies with animals, and you can actually directly tap into neurons in independent cortical columns. So what I've been doing is marrying the kind of neuroimaging literature, which looks at this kind of more of a bird's eye view of the brain, with literature from animal work that has this much more fine-grained information about cortical columns and organization at that level.
Excellent. So as you mentioned, you had a very, very good mentor. So how important was it for you? And what sort of advice maybe you can give to our grad students or early career researcher scientists?
Yeah, I think I would say that you come into your work maybe with an idea of exactly what you think you want to study. And one thing is that that may change, or, you know, over time, your interest may change, or the nature of the question that you want to investigate may change as new developments arise. So finding a mentor who's studying exactly the topic you want to study may not be as important as finding a mentor who will support you and that you feel kind of looks at you as a fellow human being who needs to be supported as well, you know, kind of a reciprocal relationship, right? So there are some kind of unhealthy relationships where it kind of the question is, what can you, student, do for me, advisor, as opposed to kind of what can we do for each other? And how can I support you just as people supported me when I was coming up as a graduate student? So you want to, you know, kind of listen to your gut when you talk to people, I think, and really put a lot of importance on finding somebody who seems really interested in developing you and helping you develop to do what you are passionate about, and, you know, can help you learn some of the techniques that you need. But I would say exactly their topic of what they're studying is less important than getting the tools and getting the kind of support of somebody who wants you to be their peer in the near future and thinks of you as their future peer.
Oh, that's such a great advice. Yes. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
So how did you come to writing this book?
Well, you know, it's funny because I for a time I did some postdoctoral work after my graduate work, and then I actually left research for a while. I really have always, my other love besides the brain has always been writing, and I had never really explored a career outside of research, so I wanted to do that. So at that time, I started, I wrote a blog. I did a tremendous amount of reading of other books, you know, science books for a general audience. And ideally, I was kind of focused on things that were science books about things I didn't know about, you know, like biochemistry or something that was not what I do, and thought a lot about how people could communicate difficult ideas in a kind of intuitive fashion that would help me learn that and still be interested. So I didn't feel like I was sitting in a classroom. You know, I felt engaged and excited. So I was sort of teaching myself that. And I had just sort of been obsessed with this idea of brain maps. And I had kind of independently been collecting all these wonderful examples of different brain maps and how they sort of share these properties. And so I started to distill that and research it more intensely, and kind of prepared like the beginning of a proposal. So kind of sketching out what I wanted to write about. And, you know, if honestly, it was probably very silly for me to do that. It was very premature at the time. And I'm sure that, you know, looking back at myself, I could say, well, that's a silly thing to do because, you know, do more shorter writing. But at the time, I was so passionate. I really just wanted to dive into this big project. And I'm glad that I did now because everything worked out. And that ambitious project that at the time, I think, seemed foolhardy to others, was something that really was able to kind of grow and flourish. And with time, I was able to develop it into the full-length book. So I had some time. I had to kind of put that aside as well. I had my first daughter, and for a period of time, over a year, I was really her primary caregiver. I was home with her all the time. And so it was hard to even get to do some writing. But that was a great learning experience for me. I desperately missed science during this time. And I was in a position that I think some parents find themselves in, where childcare is actually more expensive than the money you can make in your starting salary. For a while I was at home with her. And for me, you know, I used that as an opportunity to kind of learn from my own daughter and think about her cognitive and neural development in this firsthand way. So that really got me passionate about, like, seeing how every week she was sort of, something new was clicking, and she was sort of, it's like she was becoming a person. Every week I felt, oh man, now she's a person, because she had, you know, new capabilities, new ways in which she was interacting and exploring the world, and realizing the kind of magnitude of learning that happens in that first year. And it really gives you a feeling for the importance of development. So that got me super excited about researching development in particular. I was able to return to full-time work first as an editor. So I, rather than going, I did some part-time research and went into full-time editing as the editor of Trends in Cognitive Sciences for 3 years. And that was a fantastic introduction to both a wide range of science, cognitive and neuroscience research, and also a great addition to thinking about science communication, because this journal is a reviews journal that's focused on communicating ongoing findings to a more general audience. It's still a scholarly journal, but it's a journal that is intended to be readable by undergraduates and graduate students, as opposed to kind of very jargony and difficult for beginners in the field to comprehend. So that was great, and then I picked my book back up, and I really took the time to go through it and flesh it out, update the proposal, and found an agent, and went from there. And then after I left Trends in Cognitive Sciences, I moved to St. Louis and started doing part-time research with children at Washington University while I was finishing the book. And I now am working full-time in the Department of Psychiatry.
Oh, I love this idea of you continuing the tradition of Darwin, of scientific observation of your own children.
Obviously, that's a small N, so I can't take it as necessarily representative, but it certainly highlighted both the degree to which we children just transform on a daily and weekly basis as they are exposed to the world and learning from it, and also how different children differ. You know, you go to a story time with your child and other children, and some children are fearful and some children are brave, and you know, they also have their own kind of personalities and differences that are fascinating to think about as well. That what shapes that, and how are we both similarly developing to have eventually adult-like cognitive capacities, and yet also from the very beginning quite unique in our way of experiencing and reacting to the world.
Yes, for sure. And observation is the first step towards the hypothesis generation and then testing, and then things can get quite complex. So in Brainscapes, you managed to masterfully convey some of these complex ideas, and one of them is brain maps. So can you explain what is actually brain map? Is it a metaphor or?
Yes. Brain maps are, at their heart, they have to do with neural organization. But what they really are, they're not a metaphor. I believe that they are literal. They are maps in the sense that there is a representation in your brain that is spatial. These are spatial representations. And so I think the things that challenge people when I say there are maps in your brain is like, how could that be? I think the challenging things in terms of understanding what that might mean, a map in your brain, is first of all that, you know, we can't look in the brain and see a map. So it's not like a map that we would look at, but it is a representation. So in this case, let's say you have an area of the brain, you know, we talk about the brain with like chunks of brain that do different things. This is something that we talk about in both in science and kind of in popular science, the idea that, you know, there's a chunk of your brain that helps you feel sensations on your skin, for example. But when you look inside that chunk of brain, what you find is a organization, a pattern, a representation of the surfaces of your body within that physical tissue of your brain. And those that representation is made of activity, the neurons in your brain, where they are and when they fire, what makes them fire. And that representation, though, is really at the heart of how the brain does everything it does. So if you were to pinch me on the arm, how am I to know that, you know, I've been pinched and that it was on my arm, unless there's something in my brain that's allowing me to represent both the event and the location of that experience. And so these maps are, if you can actually, you know, if you can actually imagine unfolding the curvy surface of the cortex, and not that maps are only in the cortex, they are also in the structures nestled underneath. But if you flatten it out, there are actually ways, and I talk about in the book, of seeing these maps and seeing how, for example, what you look at any given moment is represented literally in patterns of activity across the surface of your brain, or what you're feeling on your skin, on your body, is represented across the surface of your brain in ways that reflect the layout of your body. And in fact, this is just a universal theme of brains on Earth, that they are filled just chock full with maps.
So are these maps in 3D, or predominantly it's on one single layer?
That's a great question. So I don't talk a lot about, actually, I don't talk at all about cortical layers, but layers, the cortex is certainly made up of multiple layers. And so there is like a third dimension to them, which I sort of gloss over in the book. I don't mention it much because I don't want to pull too much complexity in, but they are 3D. I mean, these are 3D chunks of your brain. I'm describing them mostly in 2D, which is kind of across the surface. That's how they've been primarily explored. But again, if when you look to research with animals, where people have taken an electrode and placed it down into the surface, there are ways in which the representations in that same map at different layers, as you go down the layers of those cortical layers within a map, those representations change as well. And of course, they are, you know, receiving information. Some of them are receiving information, some of them are sending it out. So the map itself is even more complex and amazing than I am able to describe in the book, because they do have a fascinating third dimension about which we're still learning quite a bit.
So these maps, they represent the intrinsic qualities, I suppose, of the organism itself. But what about the maps of the surroundings? So does it have any relationship to the place cells? So the place cells, they won the Nobel Prize recently for their discovery?
Yes, I was originally going to have a part about place cells specifically in Brainscapes, but the editor told me it was too long and I needed to trim rather than add. I think it's kind of fascinating because we use maps our brains use maps to represent so many aspects of our world, but actually place cells are not maps. So place cells, which as you said, we use to kind of represent our immediate location and to navigate around across within space, those cells are actually, they operate in a distributed code, which is something that I talk about in the book. And that is the idea that rather than in a map, two cells that are next to each other are processing something kind of similar. So those might be, they may be, if it's two points next to each other in your kind of touch map, your somatosensory map, then they might be processing to neighboring regions on your skin. Whereas in a distributed code, that relationship falls apart and cells can be, next door neighbor cells can be representing very different places. And for example, for place cells in the hippocampus. And these two ideas, the topographic, the maps that I describe, and these distributed codes like the place cells use are actually very complementary, and they work together in the brain to give us both sort of a structure upon which to form thought and represent sensation, and also a flexibility. So those distributed codes like the place cells give us the flexibility to learn new things. And in fact, place cells are very good at, when you go to a new environment, they can kind of remap and represent that new environment. That's the kind of benefit of those distributed codes. They allow us to go to an entirely new place, have an entirely new taste or flavor that we experience, or, you know, learn about a new object and manage to fit that into a brain that has otherwise kind of been crystallized in these more structured maps that are less flexible.
Yeah, and this important distinction really helps to understand the brain maps. So something that is more intrinsic to sensing the organism itself or sensing its environment. So I'm just wondering, why do we have these brain maps? Is there any particular reason, do you think, that our brain is organized this way? Maybe from an energetic point of view?
Yes, absolutely. So the evidence suggests, I mean, the best theory is that this organization saves us quite a bit of energy day in and day out. And it also saves us quite a bit of space. So, you know, we tend to think of our mind as sort of dimensionless and sort of vast, but the brain itself is extremely limited because it has to do all the things it does on a limited diet with a, you know, a fixed number of calories, and it has to do it in a relatively small space. So, you know, whereas you could run a program and have like a factory full of supercomputers trying to solve a problem, you and I can't have something like that on our head. You know, that would be the end of us. So, really and truly, these maps are solving both problems of space and energy by putting similar representations of neurons that represent similar things next to each other, so that they can talk together with very short wires and be interconnected with short connections. We are drastically reducing the size of our brains and also the amount of energy that we need to take in with food all of the time. And, you know, the brain is a very, very costly organ. Per unit weight, it's the most costly energy-wise organ of our body. So it makes a big difference. You want to keep your brain small and you want to keep it so that you're not, you know, starving. So evolution has had a lot of reason to prioritize organizations of our physical brains in such a way that we keep them compact and minimize their fuel intake. And maps do exactly that.
So if we don't actually have the actual maps in a brain, how were they discovered?
You mean, because you can't see them when you open them up?
Yeah, I
mean,
exactly.
Yes. So we do have them, but yeah, exactly. They're not visible to the naked eye. In general, this is generally true for discoveries in neuroscience and certainly true for discoveries of brain maps in human beings, is we have learned about them through illness and damage and trauma. So, for example, the very first map to be discovered in the human brain, the motor map, which is responsible for representing actions that then are sent on to the muscles to engage those actions. That was first discovered because of patients who had epilepsy. and a very observant neurologist would, there wasn't much he could do for these patients. There was not really anything, but he would hear their stories about how their seizures started. And he would observe how, when they were under his care, if they had a seizure, it would it would show up first in one part of their body, like say, their thumb. And so the seizure always started in the thumb, and the thumb would start to twitch, and then the seizure would spread, and it would spread in a very predictable fashion. So if it started in the thumb, it might spread down the arm and then like up the arm, and then it would spread to the trunk, or, it could go the other way and go from the thumb to the face. Or if it started in the toe, it would go up the leg. So these seizures didn't sort of hop around in the brain. They had a sort of path that they would travel when they spread. And that observation led him to conclude that there was a map of movement of the body in the brain, and that when a seizure happened, which is like a kind of an out of control excitability that starts in a particular part of the brain and can spread from there, he surmised that it was spreading through the map of the body that was in the brain. And when he did autopsies, he was able to see, for example, sometimes it was a tumor or damage to the brain in these patients that was starting their seizure. So he learned where that motor cortex was and what the map, how it was laid out based on these patients and their symptoms, and then in some cases, their autopsies.
Interesting. And what about patients with microcephaly or lissencephaly, for example, the ones who have smaller cortical areas? Do they also have the brain maps that just shift to different regions?
Yes, they do have brain maps, but they are altered. And this, I don't know exactly how, because it's been a while since I've studied that, but they do certainly have brain maps, and the brain maps do still reflect inputs. For example, there's a visual cortex, but there are ways in which the changes in the local architecture of the cortex changes the properties of the kind of fine-grained representation in that cortex. So typically, and the thing about visual cortex is really any creature that can see has a visual cortex. It is just universal. We have to have that sort of a map to represent. So even in cases where a child who was one half of her brain just failed to develop when she was in utero, she developed not only a visual cortex on the other side of the brain that did develop, but she kind of developed a new organization in that visual cortex so that she could represent both input from both visual fields in that one hemisphere. So again, like the universality of the map being there is quite striking, but the details in how it's laid out very much can be influenced by a particular individual or a particular creature's brain structure or needs or body.
So what about other creatures apart from humans? Is this a universal sort of part of the brain organization?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, again, it's remarkable. From elephants to fruit flies, creatures with brains have maps, maps in those brains. And to some degree, they have the same maps. So again, if you have the capacity to see, you'll have a primary visual cortex, or V1, which is the kind of biggest map that represents what you see. But there are also ways. You have a motor cortex, which will control the map that will control the movements that you make, that is roughly laid out according to the layout of your body. But there are also ways in which our brain maps can be vastly different, in particular when we have different sensory capabilities. So I write in the book about bats who use echolocation to find prey in the dark. So we humans have brain maps that allow us to locate the general direction or air, where sound is coming from. But bats have an incredibly specialized series of maps that help them to process the ways in which their echoes are, their emitted sounds are echoed back, and turn that into a remarkable map of space around them in the dark. There are other examples that I wasn't able to squeeze into the book. One of them is the like beetles and insects. Many of them are able to actually navigate based on the polarization of light. And essentially they use the polarization of light in the open sky as a way of actually having a compass in their brain. They can essentially see the geomagnetic kind of location of which way is north at a given time. And they have a map in their brain that actually maps out the polarization of light. There's also snakes. Some snakes like pythons and rattlesnakes have little pits in their face that are actually like sensory, like touch pits, but they're so sensitive that they are, they work like infrared vision. So they detect warmth or heat coming from their nearby environment, and they have maps that allow them to represent where this warmth or heat is coming from. And this is how they can catch prey in the dark. They can see with their skin the location of warmth and say, oh, there's prey, and they can go and they can find it because they can see where it is. So it's just a remarkable variety of brain maps across the animal kingdom.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And we haven't even started to comprehend it, isn't it? How can you sense?
Right. I mean, there's some capacities that animals have, such as, I mean, some can actually detect kind of geomagnetic, kind of the earth, like it's called magnetosensation. And we are still in the early stages of figuring out, you know, how, for example, navigating birds are even able to do this, you know, where their sensory organ is for this and how it's represented. So there's a lot of mystery that remains. But it helps to explain all the magnificent and surprising things that animals are capable of doing.
So do we know if the creatures with decentralized nervous systems like octopus or starfish also have maps?
That's a great question. I do not directly know. I am intrigued by the nervous system, from what I've heard of the nervous system of the octopus. But I actually do not. I would assume that they have their own kind of maps, because maps are so universal, and they, even though they're decentralized. So actually, I don't know. Let's find out
maybe
together.
Maybe each node has its own some specific map, because, right, you know, with the octopus, if you sever its arm, it still continues doing the thing that it's doing. So perhaps it retains some sort of mapping in there.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and you know, what's interesting is that a lot of the maps that we have in our brain are mirroring maps in our body as well. They don't allow us to behave without our brain attached. But the maps for our auditory system are reflecting what's essentially a map, the layout of our cochlea. So there are ways in which, like, we are kind of mapping our peripheral system back into our central nervous. But whether, I don't know. I don't know about octopi. That's fascinating. It's a great question.
Yeah, for sure. And I haven't really found that much. So it's a really good area of research.
Tip for anyone listening who wants to study octopi.
So I was just wondering about if we take, for example, the sensory map. So if you have your skin, how good is the resolution? So if you touch one part of your skin and then you touch the next part, you know, really, really adjacent to it, mm-hmm. Do maps also mirror this resolution distance?
Yes. So they do and they don't. So I think what you're referring to is kind of sensory acuity. So the ability, for example, to poke two neighboring parts of skin and be able to tell whether you're getting mm-hmm. poked in two places versus one. And our bodies, so there's I refer to it in the book as like inequality. We have an inequality in our skin. There are parts of our bodies, like our hands and our faces, that have a lot more touch receptors, many more touch receptors, which gives much more fine-grained information about what is happening exactly where on the skin. And then our brain maps, though, they actually magnify that inequality. So then when in the brain map, if you look in the brain map, the areas that are representing these kind of high resolution sweet spots for touch are even kind of even more overly represented in the brain compared to an area like the back, your back of your, you know, your leg or your back that is going to, you're going to have things like two points will have to be much further apart in order for you to tell them, tell that they're two separate things. So what that means is that we have this like inequality in our skin. We have a similar thing happening in our retinas of our eyes. And then our brains just like capitalize on that when they create these maps so that they just further magnify those areas of our bodies or our sensory receptors that are already the most sensitive. And they preserve that sensitivity. And then what actually we do as creatures without even realizing it is that we shape our actions in order to capitalize on that inequality and that preservation of information. So, you know, when you go to the store and you pick up a fruit or you consider buying a shirt, you might reach out and touch something, and you're going to do that with your hands. That's your sweet spot for interacting with the world and getting really fine-grained information. And likewise with our eyes, we have a portion of the retina called the fovea that is just packed with more high resolution light receptors. And so what we do is we just move our eyes around all day long without even realizing it so that we can put whatever we want to see at very clear resolution at the fovea. And so in this way, we've sort of really shaped our behavior based on how we've kind of have these very refined, magnified brain maps.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we talked predominantly about the more autonomous sensory maps that we have in the brain. What about our thought processes? Are they impacted by maps?
Yes, absolutely. And that's something that I explore later in the book. And I think it's just fascinating because there are many ways in which we actually rely upon our sensory maps, our motor maps. And we also have spatial maps that represent the kind of locations of sort of salient objects or experiences in our direct environment. And these maps, we wind up reusing them for more complicated business. For example, working memory, when you try to remember something, like something that is auditory or verbal, you repeat it and you're repeating it in your when you repeat it, you're actually using auditory imagery. And I think one of the big things that I discuss in the book is that imagery, visual imagery, auditory imagery, even olfactory imagery or smell imagery, these kinds of imagery are you can see them, that activity is in the respective sensory brain map. So, you are using that same architecture in your brain to imagine, throwing a ball or eating a Jolly Rancher or, seeing a familiar face. You're using the same architecture, sensory architecture, as you are using when you actually perceive those things in real life. And so, so the first kind of thing that falls out of that is that, oh my goodness, we are our imagination is enabled, but also constrained by these maps, right? Because this is the infrastructure, the scaffolding upon which we form those sorts of representations that we experience as imagery. And then imagery itself has just wide-ranging uses. So we can use it for working memory, like repeating something or trying to keep in mind, hold a picture in mind. We can use it for remembering something that we have seen or experienced in the past. And, we use it in kind of a similar form when we dream. So dreaming is also kind of occupies our brain maps in ways that are similar to waking sensory experience. But then in terms of like higher thought, there are ways in which we, for example, as I've described, these maps are, they're generally very spatial, very concrete. They're sort of built upon our physical bodies and the kind of spaces around us. But we have to think quite a bit about very abstract things as we get older and have to balance our budget and plan for the future and, figure out our love life and all those things. So there are actually ways in which we, when we're trying to represent complex things that are abstract, we use these spatial maps and to some degree sensory maps to help us to represent this information. And for an example of that, scientists, when they want to represent data, they create a chart of it. They turn it into a spatial picture. And that spatial picture is instantly kind of comprehensible to scientists in a way that, giving the information in a more direct form would not be, because we actually struggle with abstract things like number or time directly. We really are much better at representing them as spatial phenomena, even though they aren't inherently that. So a lot of that, I think, stems from these brain maps and the ways in which we harness them to represent more complex abstract information as we kind of grow and develop into adulthood.
And what technologies can be used to directly read the brain maps?
Yes. So this is something that has been emerging in recent decades. And I focus on it later in the book. I think it is fascinating and very important for our society to be aware of. So I mentioned that I use functional MRI as a scientific technique, and there are ways of being able to read out information from another human being's brain just by putting them in an MRI machine and running the MRI machine and looking at the results. And so one of the examples that I give that's kind of most dramatic is work in the last 15 years showing that patients who appear to be vegetative, like kind of comatose, totally unresponsive to sound or light, they just sort of sit there, and their loved ones don't know whether they are at all aware of their surroundings. And yet research with functional MRI has shown that some of these patients, about 20%, you can actually tell them to imagine something and see the activity in those parts of the brain maps where they should be, that imagery should appear. And that is this kind of remarkable indicator that they, although they can't move their body or even necessarily move their eyes to show you that they understand, they are understanding instructions and able to carry out kind of complex imagery tasks in their brain on command. And so that is like one example of how functional neuroimaging gives us a remarkable capacity to try to kind of see into a brain that otherwise would be walled off, and that otherwise, now we know something about that this individual is conscious, is aware, and even have some ways of trying to get information from them, like ask them a question and have them imagine two different things to give us the answer. So that is like one of the kind of remarkable things that neuroimaging can do. But there's also still, a lot of limitations, both because of when you fail to find a result, or just the expense and the scarcity of MRI machines. And then, I also talk about implants, which are they have remarkable capacity to pick up things like intended movement in the brains of paraplegic patients, and translate that into the movement of, for example, a robotic arm or a cursor, so that somebody who would like to type emails to his family but is paralyzed from the neck down can do that using his mind. or her mind. So it's incredibly powerful, that the potential for kind of empowering people who have lost capacities that they have. But as it kind of develops this ability to read minds and to kind of decode what these brain maps are telling us, I do encourage, I think it's important for us to think as a society about what kind of restrictions we should put on that technology, in terms of how do we make sure that we protect individuals' privacy and sovereignty, and make sure that, you know, you can't hack into their implant, and make sure that their information derived from their implant is not able to be used for advertising. And all of these questions, you know, we have put a lot of restrictions on kind of health privacy and other domains, and thinking carefully about where this technology might be headed. I think it's really important for kind of protecting individuals, both patients and the general population who might be interested in experimenting with this technology if it becomes safer in the future.
Well, yeah, for sure. And with great technology comes great responsibility. And it's such a powerful technology if we can really apply it. So I was just wondering whether you think it also can help with some of these psychiatric disorders like PTSD, if we have such a close association of conscious thought with the brain maps that can be sometimes maybe perturbed?
You know, that's a good question. So I have not seen any attempt to kind of use the sensory brain maps or interfere with them. There are examples of, for example, like using TMS, or there's some deep brain stimulation that sort of resets the way that circuits interact within the brain in neuropsychiatric illness. And those have, in some cases, afforded benefits, clinical benefits for some patients. In terms of what there are maybe more direct, if you mean like you could kind of disrupt a particular traumatic memory. But I don't think you could do that with brain maps, because the memory, when it is, you know, not being relived and kind of reinstantiated, it is kind of stored in this distributed code in a way that would be protected once it's kind of been consolidated.
Excellent. Yeah, that clarifies it. So as we mentioned earlier, some of the other animals have some super interesting senses, like a magnetosensing or infrared sensing, and they all require maps. So do you think that in the future, when we develop some sensors that can convey this information to humans, we will have the ability to create the new maps for these new senses? And what would be your sense of choice?
That's a great question. I've actually thought a lot about this. There have been studies with rodents, for example, where they've kind of like implanted an external sensor that can detect, for example, one that can detect infrared light, and then they kind of plugged it into the tactile area, the tactile map, this metasensory map of the animal. And eventually that animal sort of learned how to use that infrared information from its kind of artificial sensor that was plugged into its brain to sort of find a treat. And I think there's no question that if you take an adult animal or human and you implanted them with a new kind of sensory input into a map, that they would learn how to process that information. But how they experience it is another question. So, you know, for example, when the rats experienced this infrared light in their somatosensory cortex, they reacted like they were being touched. Something was on them. And eventually they learned that it meant something different, but I think they probably still experienced it as touch. So, you know, when you get to adulthood, I think the capacity to truly implant an entirely different sensory capacity is probably gone. I mean, we have not tested this, but I think, you know, because of the way that the territory gets kind of divvied up in a semi-permanent fashion. I mean, it certainly remains somewhat flexible later in life, but when there's brain damage later in life and you see a brain area kind of damaged, it can reorganize to some degree, but it doesn't have the plasticity, the ability to change that the very young developing brain has. So I think the question would be, I think if you implanted, you know, I think maybe the newborn brain, the developing brain could take an implant like that and maybe could actually represent it in kind of as a separate sensory experience. For example, we have some evidence from ferrets, a very classic study where the ferrets' kind of brains were rewired. So they were experiencing, like they were kind of getting, one brain map was getting information from a different modality. And they actually learned to process, they created their own map for that sensory modality, and they treated it as a separate sensory modality. So that is a capacity that I think the developing brain has at a very young age. But I think, you know, very rapidly we lose that, we sort of stabilize. And so the ability to introduce something totally different, like if I were to sew on a new body part to you, you know, what part of the brain would be able to represent that, and how, it gets very challenging. And so, I think, and as I say in the book, you know, we have like the capacity to do infrared technology with goggles. So, you know, if you can put on your goggles and see infrared, you know, why stick something in your brain and try to make it? So my personal preference is to have all of the equipment I need to sense what I need when I need it, you know, have my compass ready when I need a compass, and rather than mucking with the brain.
We just outsource your superpowers.
Exactly. And you know what? That's what we're amazing at as humans. We outsource a lot of how we think and what we do. And exactly. And that's really been a wonderful way to optimize making the most of our brains.
Excellent. Well, Rebecca, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us, what are you currently working on?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I can tell you it is not another book right now. Mm-hmm. I'm recuperating from the last one. But it is, I am doing quite a bit of research. So I am and catching up in papers that need to be written for my scientific research. So I'm particularly studying in the psychiatry department, studying brain development and sort of neural trajectories that can lead to psychopathology. I'm really interested in sensory sensitivity in very young children and in middle-aged children. So kind of children who are having a very strong reaction to sensory stimuli. And, you know, this kind of pattern of response to sensory stimuli has been linked to, it's very common among children with autism. It's very common in many neurodevelopmental disorders. It's also linked to psychopathology, mental illness. And it can be in high rates in children who are kind of identified as gifted. So there are ways in which this is sort of a marker of a sort of a different way of the brain working and reacting to the environment that can convey kind of challenges and benefits, sort of depending on the situation. So I'm trying to understand that better, understand what's happening in the brain when children experience this kind of sensitivity, and kind of why it may then lead to the challenges that some children go on to face in terms of mental illness.
That sounds very exciting and super important work. So I'm looking forward to reading those papers.
Thank you.
So where can our listeners find more information about your work and your book?
Well, I do have a website, gardenofthemind.com. And it was formerly my blog, and I put some materials about the book up there as well. And I do sometimes tweet on GOTHEMIND, so Go the Mind, and share some kind of updates on the book and the process of its release. Yes, that's, and also of course the publisher has a website.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.